ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making its One Nation.
This is the unlikely story of One Nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
G'day, it's Hamish McDonald here. Over the next couple of weeks on Global Roaming, we're revisiting the stories that have had the biggest reaction from you. These are the episodes that really speak to the crazy times that we're all living through. This episode, which Gerry and I did together, begins around the visit of the Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney. He was in Australia in March of this year. It was just a few weeks into the Israel-US military operations in Iran, and Iran had retaliated with missile and drone strikes on Israeli territory. There were civilian casualties and damage to infrastructure on both sides. As Geraldine and I said at the time, there's nothing quite so volatile as an unfolding war, and much more was to come, of course. Sadly, that turned out to be correct. This is Global Roaming, looking back at the beginnings of a deadly conflict. For all the bravado and swagger of the US and Israel right now, have you stopped to consider, might the Iranian regime survive this? What would that mean for Israel, for the US, for the region?
There's nothing quite so volatile as an unfolding war, with much to come, both within the region and the United States itself.
I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doog. This is Global Roaming.
Well, Gerry, it's an interesting moment, isn't it, for the Canadian Prime Minister to be visiting us here in Australia, given what he said just months ago about effectively the end of the rules-based order. And we find ourselves in a situation where Australia, our government, is tacitly endorsing what the US and Israel are doing in the Middle East, whilst also acknowledging, look, if you want the legal arguments, go to the US, and the US is overtly saying, we're not really making a legal argument for this.
It is interesting. I mean, he spoke at the Lowy Institute, and he also spoke, of course, to the combined parliaments. A very considered speech. Let's listen to what he said at the Lowy.
The United States and Israel have acted without engaging the UN or consulting with allies, including Canada. So the question is, where to from here, given we have a rapidly spreading conflict and growing threats to civilian life across the region? We implore all parties, including the US and Israel, to respect the rules of international engagement.
Okay, so how do you do that when none of the players say they're interested in that currently? Iran's saying we're not talking about the nuclear program at all. There are no talks. That's Ali Larijani who said that, despite those sort of initial noises from Trump saying, well, the Iranians still want to talk. I'm open to talking. And both Israel and the United States saying, well, this was preemptive. There were immediate threats to us.
We've just got to wait a little bit. It's very early days. I'm not saying I like any of this, but I have been stunned a little bit that people believe that you're going to get people seeking a diplomatic off-ramp at this point in a war like this.
But I suppose I'm raising this question now because the US has sunk an Iranian warship. Then you have NATO brought in, NATO defence systems, because of an attack on the Turkish. You can see how possible it might be for this to get beyond anyone's control.
Look, it's a perfect segue to our guest who's sitting there in the middle of Beirut, actually.
Kim Gattas, just one of my favourite writers, thinkers on the Middle East. We've tried to get her on the program so many times. She's so busy, Geraldine, and in demand at this moment. So we're very grateful to have her.
Kim Gattas, welcome to Global Roaming. It's great to have you join us.
Thank you. Good morning from Beirut.
After some very heavy nights, by the sound of you, just before we go into details, what has it been like being there in Beirut?
I don't want to sound flippant because this is not easy, but I'm used to it. I grew up in a civil war on the front line in a neighborhood that was in between, East and West Beirut. I've covered wars as a journalist, and I covered 2006, the war between Israel and Hezbollah. I lived through the war between Hezbollah and Israel again in the fall of 2024. And so this is a lot of déjà vu, unfortunately. I wrote a piece last year for the Financial Times about all the questions that come to you during war. And one of my questions was, how many wars in one lifetime?
Kim, I was really fascinated by a piece I think you wrote the week before this latest campaign began. You talked about really the confusion within the Trump administration about what capitulation by the Iranians might actually look like. Do you think now, having started this, the Americans are any clearer on that question?
I don't think so, Hamish. I don't think they've defined exactly their end goal, even though the White House put out a statement saying it was destroying Iran's nuclear capabilities, naval fleet, ballistic missile capabilities, and making sure, you know, Iran does not pose a threat again to the world. I still don't think they are clear. And so therefore also, it means that they've given up on the idea of capitulation or regime change, but, you know, that might pop up again. And I'm not sure they've defined, therefore, really success. But what I write also in that piece is that success will be defined by Donald Trump whichever way he wants, when he decides that he's had enough, or that the cost is too high, or that too many American servicemen have been killed, or perhaps because he comes under pressure from his allies in the region, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and so on, or perhaps because he doesn't quite know where this is going anymore. He's given a lot of very confusing messages. It's going to last 4 days. It's going to last 4 weeks. It can last forever. I'm not sure his base is ready for that. I don't think the Republican Party is ready for that. The Democrats are certainly not ready for that. And so I suspect we could see within a few days a statement by Donald Trump unilaterally declaring ceasefire, just the way he did last year during the 12-day war between Israel and Iran, which the U.S. then joined at a later point. That doesn't mean that Israel will stop its strikes. And I'd like to remind your listeners that although there's a ceasefire in Gaza and there's been a ceasefire in Lebanon for over a year, Israel continues to strike both places repeatedly, almost every day. So what we're living through today in Lebanon is an amplification, is a return to a higher tempo. But strikes in Lebanon have been a daily occurrence over the last year since the ceasefire. So the United States may decide that they're wrapping up their part of the operations, but Israel could well continue.
But Kim, what do you think, in not capitulation, but what do you think the range of thoughts might be underway in Iran, especially with the decision to make Mojtaba Khamenei the new supreme leader? Who apparently has, under the pressure of the guards, apparently has a very interesting sort of straddling of the religious and the sort of the secular world, if I can put it like that. So, I mean, obviously there's all sorts of recalibration going on there too.
Well, there's one goal in Iran for the Islamic Republic, and that is survival. And it is outlasting whatever the US and Israel throw at them. And it is all about exuding calm and control. So they're going on with their, you know, decisions to appoint Mojtaba, or appointing a three-member leadership council, including the president of Iran. They are making statements to the effect of, you know, we're ready to fight a long war. For them, it is all about survival. And survival is defined differently by them. They could be ruling over a heap of rubble. As long as they're ruling, they will call it survival. They will say, we have defeated the United States because we are still standing. And the terrible thing about that, of course, is what it means for the Iranian people.
Kim, I might be wrong, but it strikes me that a lot of this analysis around this moment suggests or assumes that individual actors or collections of actors are in control of events. Is there, in your mind, a point where it tips and this conflict has its own momentum that can't be controlled, and then there can't be a decision made by the US or by Iran to actually bring it to a close?
I think it's a very good question because we are, I think, already in what I heard one military expert define as the escalation trap. I think we're already seeing that we're way beyond even what the US anticipated would happen. I personally did not expect that they would be successful in killing Ali Khamenei, and therefore I did not suspect that we would reach the point where Iran would target civilian targets in Gulf countries. That, for me, was very much the last step that Iran would only reserve in case of the fight to the death. And I did not expect that that moment would arrive so quickly. I thought that was still much further down the line. But as soon as you assassinate Ali Khamenei, you are in that fight to the death. And the armada that the American president sent to the Middle East brought us to this point where already a diplomatic off-ramp was difficult. But I think we're still going to find out a lot about what really happened in those negotiations, whether they were laid as a trap to calm the suspicions of the Iranians about an imminent strike. I don't think they would have been caught at this twice. Or whether indeed the Iranians did come with extreme demands, like we will never give up enrichment, which made it inevitable and impossible for the U.S. to even find a way out of this diplomatically. And so how we get off this escalation trap, I'm not 100% sure yet. I think we'll see this evolve for a few more days, and it's possible that by the weekend, Donald Trump may decide that he's had enough.
Who would say it was over inside Iran? Like, it's interesting that that outlet, Iran International, is in talking about Mojtaba Khamenei being appointed, that, you know, they're at least considering the possibility that they could just go for broke, as you're saying, continue, or they could say there's been enough damage and we'll, in effect, find a way to, I mean, sue for peace was the old term, sue for different terms. What sort of agency do they have? And is it the guard or is it Khamenei?
Can I just also jump in on that? Because I read after the 12-day war last year, the Iranians decided to sort of disaggregate the structure of their own military and the IRGC so that they were less vulnerable to an attack like this, effectively different brigades now operating independently. Is that correct, Kim?
You know, this is not a leadership that you can, you know, decapitate in a day because you've killed all the people at the top. This is not a guerrilla movement. This is a country with a huge army and the Revolutionary Guard Corps and various other layers of leadership and Ministry of Interior, et cetera, et cetera. And they have been preparing for this moment and they have been preparing for a long fight. And we've heard it again and again from them. And we heard actually from the Minister of Foreign Affairs, that they were apologetic about the strike that had been conducted against Oman, the mediator in all of this and in the nuclear negotiations. And the foreign minister said, but, you know, we are now operating in a way that different entities and units are operating independently so that we can preserve our ability to function. And that means that they are perhaps already losing a little bit of command and control, but it's also very convenient for them to say that that's how they're operating and it's not his fault or not his responsibility or not the government's responsibility. I don't detect yet that it's falling apart in Iran. I really don't. There is still cohesion. They're in it together. The system is in it to fight and to win and to survive. They have a lot at stake. We don't see yet any signs of defection or a coup from within, or, Geraldine, in answer to your question, a decision to say, okay, you know, this has been too costly already, and we're ready to what? Surrender? Because the terms of the United States are unclear, and the terms of Israel are also very unclear and quite maximalist. Frankly, I'm not sure what Benjamin Netanyahu wants out of this. He has not defined it either. He has not said, for example, we're going to, you know, continue this war until there is a new leadership in place in Iran that we can talk to. He has only talked about destroying the threat that Iran represents or the Islamic Republic represents for Israel. And again, you can define that whichever way you want. Do we find out that Mujtaba is actually the pragmatic one who wants to preserve the Revolutionary Guard's ability to continue to enrich themselves by doing business and oppress their people? And therefore, he puts forward terms for the Americans that could be acceptable. I'm not quite sure what those terms were, but that is a possible scenario. And that would then be compared to the Venezuela scenario, where the regime is still in place. You remove the figurehead, the top people, but the actual system is still in place, and they come to some kind of arrangement with the United States. But I just think it's too difficult to achieve that in Iran because of the nature of the system and how they've set up and what their ideology is. But I guess there's only one way to find out, and is to see how the next days unfold and what we will hear from someone like Mujtaba.
You're listening to Global Rhyming. This is a really interesting look back at the beginning of the US-Israel conflict with Iran. And you'll notice there wasn't mention of the blockages in the Strait of Hormuz at this point. The impact of that on the entire global economy was yet to be fully understood. Our guest is Kim Gattas, talking to us from Beirut. Kim, Iran has been striking their near neighbours, civilian targets, in countries that once stood up for them in negotiations with the US and the Israelis. So wherever and whenever this ends, where does it leave Iran in terms of friendships in the region?
Well, they're very isolated. They have no friends. They used to have one erstwhile friend, and that was the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And now he's gone. The Russians are not going to show up. They might send some technical assistance or some extra ammunition or some words of support, as we heard from President Putin. But that's about it. Russia does not enter the fight for its allies. It didn't in the end for... And China. China hasn't said anything or very much, because their key relationships are with the Gulf. They can do without Iran. They cannot do without Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Gulf. And although, you know, that is all also part of the China-US relationship, or the sort of the Iran war is now going to figure in the US-Iran relationship. China's just, you know, not interested in fighting these wars in the Middle East. It wants to preserve its economic interests and its access to oil, and that's what they will be focused on. And so all this talk about, you know, the MOUs that Iran and China signed, and, you know, all this, you know, talk about the relationship between the two countries. At the end of the day, China's not interested in being involved in the Middle East war.
Mm. There is reporting now from a number of outlets that President Trump is talking to the Kurds in Iraq, which is a very interesting development. And, you know, maybe he wants to use them as some sort of proxy to provide some cover for Iranian civilians. I mean, who knows, while some sort of new rulership emerges, or maybe just to put pressure from that particular sector. Does this sound workable to you?
I think it's a terrible idea. And I think it could lead to a civil war. I think it's going to alarm many people inside Iran. The best alternative to this Islamic Republic is a pluralistic Iranian society. This is a country that has so much to offer, that has such a rich history, such a vibrant society, that has survived 47 years of Islamic Republic by constantly pushing back against the restrictions of this regime. To begin arming groups to try to foment internal dissent and chaos in the hope that this regime falls is a terrible scenario for a country of 90 million people.
Lise Doucette from the BBC says this is a sort of before and after moment in the whole region, which is exactly echoing what you're saying. I just want to hear, given you're saying you've been through so many wars, where is the creative thinking then? Like, is there creative thinking around, such as you're describing there, that could take this region into a different stage of its life, even if it hasn't experienced it thus far? Or can't you see it?
Geraldine, I have to say that it's important also to define creative, because you could argue that what the Americans and the Israelis are doing is very creative. It doesn't mean it's positive, but it's very creative, because, I mean, who assassinates the leader of another country? It's illegal. It's not sanctioned by Congress nor the UN. So, you know, who decides to just, you know, launch into this kind of war without a plan for the day after? That's, you could argue, very creative. Let's just start and see where it goes. It is outside of the box thinking. And in some, you know, dream world, it all ends well, with the regime in Iran gone and an internal opposition rising, and, you know, the war ends, and, you know, the Iranians are rewarded for their years of sacrifice with a new leadership of a country that is at peace with its neighbors and no longer, you know, supporting proxy militias in the region. And Israel decides, because it requires not just creative thinking, but also giving it a chance. It requires Israel to say, okay, we have fought enough wars, and we feel now that the best chance for a way forward is to make peace with our neighbors and give the Palestinians a chance at having their own state as well. That would be very creative thinking on a positive perspective. But I want to add, Geraldine, you know, because I sense that with the question, there is a sense of, oh, you know, the Middle East is, you know, it's always so much trouble and it's, you know, how do we ever move on from there? Everybody is responsible for where we are at this moment. This is not just a local problem. This is also a result of America's foreign policy. It is a result of decisions Israel has made. It is a result of decisions Western countries have made to try to contain the problem far away instead of trying to resolve it in depth. And so it's important for Western countries as well to accept their responsibility in the moment, for the moment that we are find them, that we find ourselves in today.
No, but it is pertinent, because in effect, dare I say, you've got a decent government, haven't you, at the moment in Lebanon that you haven't had before, partly because the Israelis stared down Hezbollah.
We have had, we do have for the first time, a government that is trying to do its best and a president that is also trying to do its best. They arrested 12 members of Hezbollah yesterday. And yes, you are right. That moment came about because Israel decapitated Hezbollah's leadership and weakened it to its, you know, weakest point ever. However, Israel has no long-term vision other than war at the moment. So it achieves these military successes with tactics, and then it doesn't follow up with diplomatic strategy or diplomatic successes. And so instead of seizing that moment and finding a way to work with the international community to help Lebanon secure and assert its sovereignty over the whole territory, Israel chose to continue to bomb Lebanon all year long. And that does not make it possible for the Lebanese government to do what it really needs to do.
In this brew that you've described, as you say, who knows what's going to happen? What is your worst prediction? What are you looking for?
Unfortunately, Geraldine, I don't really see at this moment, but things can change. Wars unfold with, they take on their own rhythm, and then you have moments of opportunity, and those moments of opportunity can be for escalation or off-ramps that provide diplomatic outcomes. I'm afraid that this ends with a neither here nor there scenario where the regime is still in place, the Kurds are being armed in the hope that they could take down the regime at some point. It'll start a bit of a, you know, armed insurgency in the country. Israel will continue to bomb Iran, not at the same tempo as now, but every now and then, the way it's been doing with Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Yemen over the last year. Israel will take over more territory in southern Lebanon. It will continue to strike Lebanon at will. It really requires vision, not creativity, Geraldine. It requires vision to be able to bring together countries in the region and the international community to put forward a vision for how this region is going to move on from this moment in a way that is also positive for the people of this region. Because the scenario I described is the worst case scenario, not just for the security of Israel and the long-term security of the West, but also for the people. Can you imagine the Iranians find themselves still under this Islamic Republic oppression after everything they've just, you know, they're going through now? And so it requires vision to be able to find the diplomatic off-ramp that creates a different future for this region.
Beautifully put. Hope someone hears. Kim, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Kim Gartas, award-winning Lebanese-born journalist. Her book is called Black Wave. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. Geraldine, so much there to think about. Your initial observation?
Do you know, her tiredness was my initial observation. She's weary of war. I just found that quite moving that she said, you know, she was a child in the Lebanese Civil War and here she is again. I did think she was very interesting. I said to her, are there any creative thoughts? And she said, well, there's a lot of creativity underway at the moment, you could argue.
Well, I heard that. What did you mean?
As you know, I believe that there's a real tendency in places other than the Middle East to believe it can never escape these sorts of clutches of horror.
But are you assuming it's not there or just that you can't see it?
No, I don't think there's nearly enough creative thought about how to move out. I think there's lots of people in the Middle East who say, don't write us off, that don't say that we are a region that can never emerge from
but
this.
But don't you think it is taking immense creativity from the entire populations of this region to survive ongoing conflict itself?
Well, look, I don't quite see it like that. One of the things I was struck by was how Kim listed everybody else but the Arabs themselves in terms of whether they have a lot of agency in all of this.
Would you describe Mohammed bin Salman, this very controversial...
Oh, he's got agency. Yes, he has.
Prince
and
Saudi Arabia.
He's trying to employ it right now. I accept that. And that's the point.
What about these other countries that have said, yes, okay, we will normalize relations with Israel? There are hundreds of millions of young people with potential and possibility living under autocratic or theocratic rule in the Arab world.
I know.
And I just think it's a bit much to ask, well, where's the creativity?
All right.
Can you imagine what it would be like trying to live under that?
Yes, but what is asked of them? What is asked of individuals? That's not an outrageous question to ask of people in the region. And I think it's quite reasonable to ask the question.
Well, I mean, the US president has invited them out onto the street while the regime is still in control.
Well,
I mean,
and they were gunned down, and that may well influence the course of events.
And it might influence their ability to express that creative thought.
Yes, I know. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying I like any of this, but if you're going to emerge and have a democratic, you've got to find a way to do it.
Yeah, but it might be easier to do if the West didn't keep intervening to have an outcome that it wants.
There's no simple answers.
So, as Kim Gartas hopes for a diplomatic off-ramp, are we there yet? Global.roaming at abc.net.au is where you can reach us. It's Hamish McDonald here. Next time, another of your favourite moments. Was Epstein running a Russian spy operation? See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.